Alive and Kicking
with Claire McKenna.
Thanks to ReproMed, IVF and fertility experts with clinics nationwide. Begin your fertility journey at ReproMed.ie.
This is News Talk.
Yes, this is Alive and Kicking. You can text the show 53106 at a cost of 30 cent. You can email aliveandkicking@newstalk.com or you'll find me on Twitter and Instagram. I'm at Claire's Lair. Coming up this morning, Brendan Courtney on why he's campaigning for a medically supervised injecting centre in his area, why our children need to read about those who dare to dream, and I meet Claire Hogan, who wants to make disability visible. So, what kind of health and wellness week did I have? Well, it was a busy one when I looked ahead, and I'm trying to get better with my diary and my planning and all of that. But usually, like I'm trekking through a rainforest, I just, you know, get to a bit of a clearing and I can see what's ahead. I could see that last week I was working loads, I had loads of early morning shifts, and somehow I had booked something in for every evening. Now, usually that would send me into a spin. I very much operate in an energy economy and I can't really take too many glitches in the matrix, as it were. But sometimes, and what I've learned this week, is that you're actually better off pushing it and getting up and out. So even though every morning when my alarm went off at 4:30 a.m., I would have a debate in my head about cancelling that evening's event. Likewise, at around 5, 6, as the evening event approached, I'd say, that's it. No, I'm just going to cancel. I'm just going to text now. And I never did. I made each one. And I'm so glad I did, because I think when all you do is just stay in and go to bed every night, even though I am a massive fan of that and I was in bed at 9 o'clock last night, which is very rock and roll for a Saturday night, sometimes I think the staying in can be more draining. So one night I was out with my mum, with my sister another, again for my hubby's birthday, and I managed to work hard, work well, if I do say so myself, and I was in great form. So my prescription for myself is get up and get out more. So there you go. And in news this week, research was released from Belong to Youth Services, which found that 73% of LGBTI plus students feel unsafe at school due to bullying. Now, Youth Work Ireland held their summit in Dublin a couple of weeks back, and their keynote speaker was Riad Khalaf, who's been on this show, and he spoke about how LGBTQI plus inclusive sex education is a rarity in the UK and Irish schools, and how everyone misses out when we leave just a few out. And UK schools are set to change their sex education policies in 2020, but Ireland lags behind here. We have a fairly outdated Education Act, which dates back to 1998. So I think if we want our children to grow up in an inclusive society with compassion, then we're going to have to start including people from school level up and, of course, in our homes. Also this week, changes made to the Public Health Alcohol Bill last year came into force this week. So those that advertise alcohol within 200 metres of a school, a creche or a local authority playground from next week could be slapped with a fine. And also from the 12th of November, alcohol advertising on public transport, bus stops or stations is also banned. Also in the cinema, unless it's an 18 classification or a licensed premises at the cinema. And promoting alcohol on children's clothing is also banned, which actually begs belief that that was even a thing. But it did spark a lot of debate on our airwaves this week about our so-called drinking culture in Ireland. But I think the tide is turning a little on alcohol. I mean, there is no question that the culture definitely exists. And you do often see a difference in the way the Irish drink when you travel maybe across Europe, and you see certain countries kind of nursing very small glasses of beer over the evening. But I think young people today are far more aware of the health benefits of not drinking. I mean, Clean Liquor is a brand which launched this week, and their gin sold out within 24 hours. And they've just joined a plethora of alcohol-free beverages that are, you know, gins and beers and all that, that I think people are reaching for. And I certainly think in my generation, it's not that much of a big deal for people to say they're not drinking tonight as it may have been for my parents' generation. I think people are looking for alternatives while still maintaining the social aspect of having a drink. I'd love to know what you think. You can text the show 53106 at a cost of 30 cent, or you can email aliveandkicking@newstalk.com. Now, it's been said many times before that we as a small Ireland nation have had a disproportionate impact on society and culture on a global scale. Now, while we as adults know of the impact of some of our most notable figures and what they have done on the world stage. Those stories may be lost on our little ones, but fortunately, my next guest has set out to remedy that. Sarah Webb is an award-winning children's author of Dare to Dream, Irish People Who Took on the World and Won, and she joins me in studio now. Good morning, Sarah.
Hello, Claire.
And last year you had Blazing a Trail.
Yes, that's right.
And they're both along the same lines. You just want to let people know about those who blazed a trail and dared to dream.
Yeah, so really how this came about was I was researching a novel a couple of years back, and it was set in the 1930s. And I came across, and it was set in the world of aviation. And I came across some women from aviation that, when I looked into it in more detail, they were actually Irish. You know, they'd been called British, but it was obviously before we had Ireland in 1916 and everything. So they'd been called British. And I started researching one of them, who's called Lady Heath. Mary Heath was her name. And I just became really, really fascinated. And then I thought, well, hang on here now. If I don't know who she is, who else is there out there? And then around the same time, there was some books in the bookshops called Goodnight Stories for Rebel Girls, which was an American book. And there was also a movement, I think, towards her story, you know, female history being told.
So to kind of break away from the whole Cinderella, the girl just waiting, or Rapunzel waiting in the tower for the man to come and save her.
Absolutely. But also just to reclaim women's history. You know, 1916, we had the centenary, and it was great to see that some of the women from 1916 were being celebrated. Rosie Hackett, who's in Dare to Dream, and Countess Markowitz. So on the back of all of that, I wrote Blazing a Trail, which was about women, Irish women who had changed the world. And then after, I go into schools every week. I really enjoy talking to school children. And I was talking to them about Blazing a Trail. And often the classes I went into were mixed. You know, there were boys and girls. And then I was kind of thinking to myself, well, actually, we all need role models who are boys, who are men and women, boys and girls. So then I thought, well, maybe for the next book I'd like to do, I'd like to redress the balance and have 50% women and 50% men. So that's where Dare to Dream came from. But I'm always really surprised when children... I was in a school on Friday in Ringsend, lovely school, but only three of them knew who Douglas Hyde was, who was our first Irish president, which is really important as a country. And I think about four of them knew who Mary Robinson is. So I think there's still some work to do. If they're not on the curriculum, often people, really interesting people from our history, don't get included in books, which I think is a shame.
And what kind of reaction do you get from kids to these stories?
Well, I always, when I talk to children, I don't tell them we're going to do history today. I always say, well, we're going to share some stories about amazing people who've done really interesting things. And that's kind of my in. And I always tell them, like, it's embedded in the word history is story, you know, and I think we all need to remember that. And it's a really good way of approaching history with kids. Just say, listen, we're going to have some stories about cool things from the past or people from the past. And the ones they're really interested in is the women from the kind of 19th, early 20th century who were doing something extraordinary in a man's world. So especially there's a woman called Jenny Hodgers who became a soldier in Lincoln's army and fought in the American Civil War. She was on the good side. She was on Lincoln's side. But they're fascinated as to why she left Ireland. She left Ireland during the famine, you know, and then they know a little bit about that. But they're fascinated why she had to change to be a boy, to be a soldier. And then we talk about, well, you know, women weren't allowed to go to college. They weren't allowed to be soldiers. They weren't allowed to be doctors or surgeons or newspaper reporters or journalists. You know, they weren't allowed to do any of these jobs, and they weren't allowed in college. The first woman in Ireland to go to college at Trinity College Dublin was in 1904, you know, and they find this kind of mind-boggling. And it's a really great way that we then talk about equality and how we want the world to be in the future. So, we have great chats. Yeah.
And now I read it to my 6-year-old daughter last night. At bedtime, we often divide and conquer. So my husband was taking on my son. So I didn't include him. It wasn't a fully inclusive reading that I did. But I was really surprised at how engaged she was with the whole thing. And we read about Madam Dragonfly.
Oh, yeah.
She was incredible. Yeah. Tell listeners a little bit about her. Cynthia Longfield.
Cynthia Longfield. They called her Madam Dragonfly. So she grew up in a time where bright, intelligent women who may have had the money to go, or their family may have had the money to send them to college, weren't sent to college because they couldn't go, because they weren't allowed. So she was fascinated by nature and science as a child, and then continued that passion all through her life. So, but she was lucky in that she was Anglo-Irish, so she was in a position that her family had the money to send her exploring around the world, you know.
Still, she took to the high seas. She travelled through Asia and Africa on her own.
Yeah. So canoes, machetes, jungles, the
no
works.
No Airbnb, no Google, no nothing. No. Imagine.
No. And she was basically out there looking for new species of insects. So she discovered loads and loads of new dragonflies were her great passion. And as adults, we kind of go, that's a bit weird. But kids love this. You know, they love the fact that she was passionate about these amazing creatures. If you've ever seen a dragonfly, they are quite magical looking. And they love that. And I think just her story is incredible because she died at 94. So she spent her entire life studying and looking after insects, who are a very important part of our ecosystem. Yeah.
You also have more modern stories, like Cora Staunton also features, and as well as all her sporting accolades, which are many, and how she continued once with a broken nose. She just bandaged it and kept going.
Amazing woman.
You also add in little things like she wore trousers on her confirmation. Yeah. So there's other little things that you include as well as the bigger things.
But also, I mean, Cora had a tough life when she was growing up. Her mum died when she was a teenager. But she managed, you know, she coped. And I think I've met her now twice, and I think she's a really interesting woman. And I think it's really important that we tell children that it wasn't always easy for these people. The other person I really enjoyed researching was Jack Kyle, who was an incredible rugby player. He was capped 46 times for Ireland. He played for Ireland as a teenager. And then he did medicine. Sorry, this was kind of during his time studying medicine at Queen's University in Belfast. But he failed his exams to get into medicine. And not just once, you know. He failed physics and he failed maths, and he had to repeat and keep going. And I think it's kind of, that is really important to tell children, to be really honest and just say, well, look, you know, it wasn't the first time they did something. They had to keep doing it. And then, although he adored rugby, he became a surgeon and he travelled to Africa. And when and also I was very honest about it, because I wanted to be really truthful to kids about these people's lives. So when Jack Kyle's marriage broke up, and this was a long, long time before this would have been general, he got custody of the children, and he brought up his children on his own as a single father in Africa. And I met his daughter Justine recently. She very kindly came to the book launch, and she said he was just the most incredible father, you know. And I just wanted to bring out that aspect of him as well, as a really loyal, dedicated and lovely father. And it's still, when I read her memoir about him, she said to me, my father was a guy. Oh, no, she said to me, if the galaxy was decent. Oh, I can't remember the quote. Sorry, Claire, I'm getting it muddled.
Not at all.
But she was saying basically that he was the most decent man in the galaxy. And how much she loved him. And it really came across in her book. So I try to get that across to children as well, that there's many aspects of people's lives. You know?
And I mentioned to you before coming on air about Alain de Botton, the philosopher last week, saying, you know, we should be celebrating the ordinary as well. And you have brought that in a little bit. You're not saying we all have to aim for these lofty heights. But as you say, you've included all facets of people's successes and personalities, and I think it's a great book for anyone to have on their bookshelf. I know you are a children's author, but we all have lessons to learn from there. And Sarah's book is shortlisted for the journal.ie Best Irish Published Book of the Year category at the On Post Irish Book Awards 2019. Have you a nice schooner for Wednesday night?
I have one that I've had for many years, Claire, but I
like
have a
it.
New little jacket and I'm getting my hair and makeup
sustainable
done.
Sustainable fashion,
for me.
I like it. And highlights of the awards presented by Miriam O'Callaghan this year will be broadcast on RTÉ One Television on Saturday the 23rd of November. So you can check out Sarah then. Sarah Webb, thank you very, very much. The book is called Dare to Dream, Irish People Who Took on the World and Won. We're going to take a break, but then I'm going to be speaking to Brendan Courtney on why he's campaigning for a medically supervised injecting centre in his area.
Alive and kicking on News Talk.
Thanks to ReproMed, IVF and fertility experts with clinics nationwide. Begin your fertility journey at repromed.ie.
So he's well known in the world of fashion and on our TV screens, but now Brendan Courtney is lending his voice to a campaign for Ireland's first supervised injecting facility set up in Dublin. And in case you're wondering, it's right beside where he lives, and he joins me in studio to tell me more. Well, you're very welcome, Brendan.
Thank you so much.
And the reason I say it's close to where you live is because I think that's really important, because everyone says, oh yes, look, it's terrible and drug addiction is terrible.
Yeah.
But when it comes to either an incinerator or an injection facility, nobody wants it in their backyard, but you do.
Well, I live next door to Merchants Quay Services, which came about from, I think they were Jesuit priests, because there's a beautiful church there. You wouldn't even notice it. Basically, homeless people were sleeping in the church in like the 40s and 50s in Ireland. So they opened a canteen at the back to take them out of the church, basically, and to clear the street. So the Merchants Quay Services is a charity, and it happened there because it's really inner city Dublin, and inner city attracts homelessness. It just does, okay? And then around that is addiction. So those services are there because they're needed there. I moved into Usher's Quay, which is right beside it, literally 2 seconds from it. And they moved into their new premises, which is on the riverfront, which was an old theatre, actually. There used to be panto in there. And they bought that premises and they moved in there about 7 years ago. And I walk by every day, 3 or 4 times a day, and wondered for 2 years what it was, until one day I picked up the courage and went in and discovered what they do. So it's kind of been a silent, silent keeper there. It's been ticking along, doing its thing. And so I live in a parallel universe to so many people who live on my street, literally on my street. I live in a beautiful apartment on the fourth floor and they live on the street. So I see it every day. So it's there anyway. That's the point of all this. And the conversation will conclude with the reason a safe injection facility works is that the problem is there. We're not bringing a problem to the area. It's there.
So what do you see? I lived in Dublin city centre myself, and homelessness, as you say, and heroin injecting does become part of your everyday. You see it all the time. Is that what you're seeing?
So I suppose, because I'm kind of immersed in it now, I'll try and keep it as clear as I possibly can, because I'm actually quite passionate about it, because I find I'm facing barriers every day with people on Twitter or people on the street who aren't pro. And then there's a lot of people who are con, a lot of people who are pro. So I suppose what I see is when I park my car, there's a couple I know and they shoot up behind my car a lot. And they're super nice. And I always go, hey, guys. And they're like, hey. And it's really funny. I wonder if she's ever listened to this. Stop speaking to me in a Dickensian accent. It's quite funny. She says, oh, hello, sir. She puts on this accent. It's really cute. And I'm like, OK. And she's trying to be respectful or reverential. It's really, so
it's
I won't.
Because you're so well dressed.
Well, it's so I won't move them on, I think. Right. And he always has his back to me. And they're always got the lighter and the ashtray or the piece of tin foil. And like, I can't really see the details, but I can see what they're doing. And then when they move off this paraphernalia there, and about 4 years ago, my nephew, who's a kid, he was about 11 at the time, picked up the needle and said, oh, look what I found. And hepatitis lives on those needles for up to a week, you know. So that's obviously charged me to go, well, that can't be on the street. But this particular couple, one day, she said, oh, hello, good evening, sir, how are you? And she said, what day is it? And I said, it's Friday all day. And I'm just sort of locking my car. And I said, be careful there now, because my car's going to move. And just, you know, just be careful when you're coming out of there, because it's a bit dangerous, the exit. And she said, okay. She said, what day is it, Friday? And I said, yeah, it's Friday. And she hit him on the shoulder. She said, it's your birthday tomorrow. And he went, oh, is it? And I went, happy birthday. And he went, oh, thanks a million. And I just had this human connection with these people. It nearly made me cry, that these are just people just trying to get on. And I see addiction as an illness now, that I live around it and see it, that they need support. And the real point of the safe injection facility is it is an emergency service. It is not a rehab. It's not a solution. It's an emergency service for people who are at the end of the line on the street, addicted. And that's why this service needs to be there, to treat these people with humanity at least. So what people get mixed up with, it's not a rehab centre. It's literally an emergency service. And the other thing that really attracted me to what the emergency services do, and this is mind-blowing, if you can't get a hostel bed at night, okay? So you start, your search starts about 2:30 in the day when the lines open. You have to have a registered homeless number. You have to have a phone. It's pretty busy.
Yeah, a charged phone. I mean, it just
now, emergency have three free phone booths. They're free if you go into the cafe. The cafe is 24/7, but you also have to be registered homeless to access the cafe, by the way. But if you can't get anywhere else to sleep, you go to emergency service and they'll give you a yoga mat and you can sleep on the floor of the cafe. And that just broke my heart. And they are at such pains to point out that that is an emergency service that they provide, and they are full all the time. And when you can't get in there, you go to the police station and they give you a sleeping bag. And that's how you live as a homeless person in Ireland. So I don't see this as a solution at all. I see it as an emergency service. And the final bit of the sort of equation that really brings people on board, I'm working with a great guy at the moment, a director, TV director. He lives nearby and he's really anti it. And every time we're filming together, I say, have I got you on board yet? He said, well, I'm nearly there. And the final piece I did get him on board with, I said, I'm going out on the patrol with the drug workers in a couple of weeks, maybe next week. And I'm going to go out at night and I'm going to see how they live and what they do. So what happens is you're an addict, you go down to emergency service and they give you a clean needle, right? So it stops the spread of disease. So they have a needle exchange. You go in with your old needle and they give you a clean needle. You then have to leave the building, go behind my car, take your drugs and dump your needle on the street. The very person who gives you the needle has to get a bag and gloves and go and collect those needles that evening. So they're giving you the needle and you're disposing of them on the street because you're high, and then they've got to go and collect them. So if it's just another service to the service that exists. And that's when people go, oh, right, okay, it's there, it's happening. We need to treat these people with humanity, basically.
I have gone out a couple of times. Now, look, I'm no Mother Teresa. I haven't fitted in as much as I would like, but I've been out on homeless super runs a couple of times. And when you meet people on the street,
yeah,
you realise how multi-layered the reasons that led them there.
Yeah.
Are,
yeah,
that there can be child abuse, there can be all kinds of reasons they grew up in disadvantaged areas. Why do you think that people are up in arms about, obviously, child abuse, child poverty, people living in disadvantaged areas, and indeed homelessness and the crisis that's going on, and yet don't have compassion for heroin addicts?
I think, and it's worth pointing out as well, a lot of people who access the night cafe aren't addicts as well. You know, they're just homeless. So they do lots of work. But the people I encounter, the people I see that need the safe injection centre, obviously are the addicts. So yes, I think there's still a misconception that people choose addiction. I think we still don't see it as an illness, even though half of our uncles are alcoholics and half of our brothers and have tried things. You know, we've experienced addiction, all of us as Irish people, in some level, pretty much all of us, I'd say, safe to say. There's someone in the family or someone next door or someone on the road or someone growing up. So we know what addiction is. We still see drug addiction as some sort of, they chose this party life to do that. People fall into addiction for generally emotional reasons or abuse reasons, absolutely. And when you hear people's stories, it's just unbelievable. I mean, I'm making a short film about emergency services as well for international film festivals to really raise awareness around the night cafe particularly. And I'm following this young girl, and she graduated from Trinity 7 years ago. And then 2 years ago, woke up getting a kick in the head from the security guard to move her out of the doorway. And she fell into addiction. Her mother died, her father died, and then her boyfriend committed suicide. And she lost all hope. She lost her home. The stories are, if you just heard a tenth of the stories, you would get compassion. You would feel, your heart would break, and you would really want to help these people. So I think it's like, and people say, just move it. It's too near the Guinness storehouse. That's been my favourite one on Twitter. I'm like, the problem is there. Two people were shot on the road behind me in the last 2 years. I'm in the city centre. It's a pretty, you know, it's a city centre.
Yeah, it's happening.
It's happening.
In the open. You're trying to make it happen somewhere.
Somewhere safe. But also the
away
other,
from eyes.
Yeah. And I suppose the other thing that came to when I've introduced the head of addiction at HSC, Addiction Services, he's an amazing guy. And I also introduced this doctor who's from a rehab clinic who's really got opinions about it as well and very pro it. And the other thing that came really clear that I wasn't aware of is if you go into a safe injection centre and you're an addict, okay, you go and you're nervous and you're uncomfortable, you go and you have your drugs, you get them wherever you get them, and you use the services. That's probably the first time you've accessed services in years. And that's literally a gateway. So that can get people into rehab. So even just getting people off the street in there, get some in conversations. The emergency services, they have a chiropodist. it's unbelievable. They have a dentist. So all these things that go wrong when you're an addict, they're trying to tackle them and get people. So their mission is always to get people off drugs and off the street.
I had to listen to your interview with Dr. Eamon Keenan. You touched on him there, the head of addiction services at the HSE. And they have spoken to addicts to get to this point of saying this is what would be a positive step for Ireland.
Yeah.
And like you said, most of them said that they would engage with support services. So they would see a counsellor. They want to get clean. They don't want to be where they are necessarily.
Yeah.
Some don't want the help and that's up to them. But as you say, this would help and this would stop people dying on the streets and this would stop your 11-year-old nephew picking up
needles
on the street.
Yeah, I mean, I'm very interested to, I'm going to interview the primary school teacher. She's the headmistress around the corner. There's a primary school near me where I vote, basically. It's a very cute little school, actually. And she's really eloquent, this woman, and very smart. And I'm very keen to interview her. She's trying to get it cleared with the Department of Education that she can do an interview with me, but she's very anti it because she's getting a huge pressure from the parents in the area. And I understand that as well. I really do understand that. But she's, you know, I've anecdotally heard of people shooting up in the green across the road from the school. There's a little bit of patch of grass. You know, the kids can see out the window and see them doing it. So I'm really curious to see how she feels about it. But people saying move it 100 yards up the road is just crazy. I've started this kind of hashtag at the moment, which is a little aggressive because it's annoying me, which is hashtag you don't get a vote. So a couple of people have come at me on Twitter and I'm like, where do you live, Kleine? You don't get a vote. You don't live there. You don't use that street. I'm not interested in what you have to say because clearly you haven't done the research because it works. They work. They get people up, you know, into services, cleans up the area first and foremost for the people who are living there. And secondly, it accesses services for drug addicts. And I suppose when you live in the area, you see it constantly every day, you know. Every day by my car is needles, every day. You know, you see it constantly. And I see the poor people coming out now, because now I know them, to pick up the needles in the evening that they've given out that morning. I mean, that must be the most frustrating job in the planet, to have to go and pick those needles up. And I suppose I'm hoping that that very action will get people over the line and go, look, they're giving the needles out anyway, they're using them on the street, they have to go and clean them up. Will we not just give them a room? And the other thing, people are worried that people will take the bus there, that it'll bring more drug addicts. No drug addict who's taken a shot of heroin is able to get on a bus, let alone find the money to get the bus. So there's not going to be a migration of new drug users to the area to use it. Absolutely not. That's never been an issue in any of the cities where there are safe injection facilities.
Well, I'd love to get listener reaction to it and your thoughts on Ireland getting its first supervised injecting facility. You can text 53106 at a cost of 30 cent. You can follow Brendan's journey, all of his interviews he puts up on his social media, on his Instagram. Brendan Courtney, thank you very, very much.
Thanks so much. And thanks for letting me voice it. It'll mean a lot to everybody involved.
Thank you for coming on. And I have had a good few texts already. George in the Liberties says, Claire, what about the people who live in the area? Surely they are allowed to say that they don't want a centre in their area. Having a centre, as suggested, will obviously bring a huge number of drug addicted people into that area. People are entitled to say no to that. Yeah, and I mean, I totally get that, George. And, you know, even before the interview, I was obviously talking to Brendan. He said, listen, you know, he gets it as well. It's not like it's his dream to have a medically supervised injection centre beside his home. He wishes there wasn't drug addiction, heroin addiction, that it wasn't going on in his area anyway. But I think that is just always the underlying thing in it. The fact that it is happening and it's happening out in the streets and it's taking it off the streets and hoping to get these people help so that it doesn't happen at all. But, you know, I completely understand, you know, as does Brendan, the people who don't want it. And I suppose he's just challenging those thoughts with some information. And I mean, to be fair to him, he's speaking to the experts and getting himself well read on the whole thing. And what a fantastic, humane guy, says Sinead. I wish him every good thing in the world. And one says, looking at the location of Merchants Quay Injection Centre is wrong and would be highly destructive to an area already undermined by high concentration of drug treatment services. The details of how an SIF works is conveniently not discussed by Brendan and other advocates. For this service to work, a zone is created in which illegal drug distribution is ignored. A Dublin 8 primary school will be within this area, yet no alcohol adverts 200 metres within a school. And again, look, I totally get it. You know, I mean, I, as I said, have been influenced by being out in the street and meeting some homeless people. So I always try and operate with compassion. But, you know, I'm raising a young family as well. And I would understand why my hackles would rise if it was planned beside my kids' school. So, look, you know, we get it. But I think it's worth discussing, particularly when there are needles out on the street, particularly when it's happening in front of the school in the view of the students. So, you know, we need to start this conversation about this, how this can be tackled. And I'm interested to get your thoughts. 53106 at a cost of 30 cent. Cost of 30 cent. We'll take a break. I need one.
Alive and kicking on News Talk.
Thanks to ReproMed, IVF and fertility experts with clinics nationwide. Begin your fertility journey at ReproMed.ie.
Now, I received an email during the week and I'm just going to read part of it to you. It says, "Hi, I'm looking to start a conversation and make disability visible. I want to challenge the makeup industry, TV, media, social media and shops on the high street to use people outside of the so-called norm, in inverted commas. I want to open doors that have long been shut in my face and the face of others. These industries cannot just be about, again in inverted commas, normal people. From the moment I was born, I was different. Achondroplasia happens in one in every 25,000 births. People with it are small in stature. My family cares for me and at the same time has never shielded me from the world. That's how they raised me. I am Claire. Expectations are not lowered. We can talk about it whenever I need to, but I have not been allowed to hide. Even so, living as a little person is like being the main attraction at the circus every day of my life. Going grocery shopping, booking a makeup appointment, going to a car dealership to buy a new car. It's like being a celebrity and the whole world is my paparazzi. My sister always says, if I had a euro for everyone that looked at me, I'd be a billionaire. It's like being a celebrity without fame or money. And that is pretty accurate. Now, I don't wake up every morning and think, oh, woe is me, I am a little person. I wake up and I get on with my day. My first thought is usually what's for brekkie or how I'm so lucky to have a wonderful husband and two amazing stepdaughters. I fly out of the house in whatever outfit I've pulled together the night before. But like a kick in the chest, I am startled because someone interrupts my morning routine by pointing, laughing or just taking a picture. I am no longer just Claire, the free-spirited person. I am the little person who deserves ridicule. I have to interact with someone who thinks my mere existence on this planet is a joke. It's not a great way to start a day." Well, we have started her day a little differently today because Claire Hogan joins me in studio now. Good morning, Claire.
Hi, Claire. How are you?
I was really touched by your email. And that's why I asked you here to tell your story. And we've had a bit of a chat on the phone. And you said that even that can be something. You can talk to somebody on the phone and they'll kind of get you. They'll get your strong, feisty personality. Mm. They'll know who you are. And then when they meet you face to face, everything changes.
Oh, 100%. Like people, I can sell myself very good. I can conduct myself on a phone. I can conduct myself through emails. But when like someone comes up to me and, you know, when I say, oh yeah, I'm Claire, I'm the girl that you were on the phone to, or I'm Claire, the person that you were emailing, they literally, it's like they're, I can see their face dropping. I can see the whole expression change. But like, it's not like that for everybody. I sense that a lot, like from a lot of people. You know, I was in school. I was, you know, the only person with achondroplasia. It's the word that haunted me my whole life. Like,
Can you describe what it is for people?
Yeah. So achondroplasia, it's like basically it's short stature. It's a mutation of the FGFR3 gene. I come from a family of five. I have a brother and I have a sister. They're both of average height. My parents are of average height. And we, when I was younger, we went to see a geneticist and we went back generations. Achondroplasia doesn't run in my family.
Yeah. And it's not a term we talk about very much either. I had never heard of it before. Mm. And yet I have seen people who are of shorter stature before. Yeah. Why don't we hear that term?
We don't hear it because there's such a stigma in relation to achondroplasia. Like if you see someone with achondroplasia, like there's a stigma attached in terms of like people expect people with achondroplasia to be like in Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. Yeah. They expect them to be Santa's little helpers. They expect them to be like, and that goes back, like I've looked through it, like I've done a lot of research and I've looked back through books, but that goes back in history. Like there used to be, it was different, you know, and now people are allowed to talk about it. When I was growing up, there was no platforms to speak about like anything like this. Like my parents, people used to say to my parents, oh, why don't you put her in a place for people with achondroplasia? But like, that's labelling me. My parents never wanted to label me. But people still put people with my condition in a box, label me, and to be not spoken about as such.
And I think what you were saying about people and their attitude changing when they meet you is down to their own discomfort, or sometimes with the best of intentions, wanting to say the right thing. And in this very politically correct world, people can be afraid. So are terms like dwarfism or dwarf, are any of those acceptable anymore? Does that language need to be changed?
Well, that like I think that language, in terms of like, people have come up to me in the street and said to me, oh my God. Like, and then they would say like, are you like a dwarf? That hurts, like because I don't feel different. I don't, like on the inside, I am like Claire Hogan. I am like 6 foot tall. I am, you know, I can like, I can do anything. I can achieve anything. But it's like people that have these labels put on me make me not like reach my potential.
They define you purely by your height.
Absolutely.
I mean, no one's ever stopped me in the street and asked me, am I 5'5"?
But nobody would ever come up to me. Like, nobody would ever come up to my sister. My sister's 6 foot tall. Nobody would ever come up to my sister and say, oh my God, like, hiya, you're 6 foot. I can't believe you're 6 foot. You know, it's just, or nobody would ever go up to a fat person in the street and say, oh my God, you're fat. There needs to be more discussion. I think there's a lot done. I think there's a lot more to do. Even in work, when I work in a bank, and I've like proved myself time and time and time again. And like on paper, on a CV, like I cheat, I think I'm good. But then when I go for the interview, or when I go for you know, to meet the person, like instantly, I feel that like, They've made the decision, you know, and that's a very hard point to prove. Like, in terms of like I can hardly say, well, why didn't I get the job, or why wasn't I successful, or you know, do you think it's because of myself? Because I'm lowering my standards. If I start asking questions like that, I'm lowering my standards about me. When I know that I'm capable, do you know?
Yeah, 100%. And you said that there have been a couple of times where you've walked into a job interview and they've said, oh, you're Claire, as if they were surprised that the person they'd been reading about was
all
the person
time
in front of them.
All the time. Like I'm not saying I go for jobs, like, but all the time. But I've been up against that all my whole life. Like there's, you know, there's been instances where like I could write books in terms of the amount of incidents that I've come up against and fight hard against, you know. Like I'm happily married, and you know, my husband is absolutely amazing. He sits me so high up on a pedestal. But like, let me tell you that Robert is like 6 foot tall. You know, he's like, he's normal. But like, and I even hate using that word normal, because what is normal? Like I think that like the likes of social media, you know, we are defining normal to be like aesthetically correct and beautiful. But like, what is beauty? You know, everybody is different. Everybody has a story to tell.
You were the first person in Ireland to have limb lengthening surgery. That must be fairly full on.
Like, I had the best parents, like, and I still do. My mom and my dad, like, they fought hard for me. They fought, like, they never, anything that I was up against, like, if I came in off the street, oh, mom, you know, such and such called me a name, my mom be like, get out. I don't want to hear about it. Get out. And like, looking back, that made me the person I am today. Growing up, mom was always, like, we were always in and out of hospital. As part of my condition, there's like, you could have spinal problems. I had my legs, the lower leg was bow shaped, and that's part of the achondroplasia. So my mom was always determined to get the bow corrected.
So it wasn't about making you taller.
Exactly. Yeah. But I was 13 at the time, and there was nobody in the hospital that did limb lengthening surgery. Like, I was under a specialist for it, for for different things. And he said to my mum one day that this guy, David Moore, is coming in and he specialises, he's an orthopaedic surgeon, specialises in limb lengthening. So my mum was like, get me on the list. You know, Claire needs to see this man. So I remember walking in, and I can vividly remember, I've goose pimples, walking in, and David would he looked at my mum and dad and he was like, oh, hello, you know, and then he looked at me and he spoke directly to me and to me only. And he was like, do you want this? Do you need, like, you know, this is what we're going to do. We're going to put like rings on, he always said rings on your legs, like a frame. And, you know, like he said, like, it's going to be painful. It's going to be sore. He said, but I will promise you that I can, number one, correct the bow shape. But number two, I can lengthen you. And I was like at 13, you know, I was coming into my teenage years. I was like probably a brat, you know.
I know, we've enough going on at that time,
yeah,
don't we?
Yeah, yeah. And then we went ahead then with surgery. But like everything that could go wrong did go wrong. I'm not saying like that, like it was bad, but it was very difficult. Like I'd have to, you know, even getting up and setting the alarm to turn the dial on the frame every 6 hours, the pain of it, the physiotherapy, and it was all new. Like the physiotherapist, they didn't come up against this because, you know, they didn't, it was new to them. So like them teaching me to get back up and walk, them teaching me to, you know, the nurses teaching me to clean the frame, to have clean hands. So it was very difficult time.
And for how long?
It was 18 months. So I was in and out of hospital for a good 18 months. And that was it was very tough. But the bow was corrected and it was fantastic. I would have been going into I missed third year of school. So my parents said to me to do fourth year. So I went and I did fourth year. And as part of fourth year, there was work experience. And I remember I got my work experience in Crumlin Hospital, and that's where I had all the procedures done. And I remember going in and I remember seeing David, and he said to me, listen, come and have a chat with me. I would have been 15, 16. I was so aware of my condition back, like, because I was a teenager, because like all my friends were like, you know, it was about boyfriends and it was about like clothes and it was about
discos
and everything, yeah, like that. But like, and then he said to me, Claire, you know what? He said, I can do the top of your legs, he said, and I will give you, he said, a few inches as well. He said, and I think that's going to be good for you, you know? And he said, go away, think about it. And I remember going home to my parents and I was like, oh my God, I'm after having a chat with David and, you know, this is what he wants to do and maybe I should, maybe I shouldn't. It's going to be another rough ride and it's going to be hard. And like I was, as I said, like I was a strappy teenager. Like,
and you knew what to expect this time, right?
Exactly. And that was the fear. The fear was real. It was very real. But I went in and I had it done and it was tough. It was another 18 months and it was 18 months out of my life. It was like, you know, it was extremely difficult.
So you must have spent a lot of time on your own. So you got to really work on your own spirit then,
yeah,
because
yeah,
you don't strike me as the person that feels sorry for herself.
Oh,
even
I
though you could.
Yeah,
you could.
Yeah, yeah. I certainly can feel sorry.
Not now, but
not
during
now.
That treatment.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But definitely there was times. I remember there's a funny time, like they didn't know what to do with me in terms of like I was going through a really rough time. And I remember the nurse coming in to me and she says to me, you're going to see somebody. And I was in a wheelchair and I was like, who, you know? And then they were like, never mind who, we're just going. So off they wheeled me down to outpatients and they literally wheeled me into this room about the size of this room here. They wheeled me into a room and then they turned around and said, this woman, she was an American, she goes, hi, I'm a child psychiatrist. And then I was like, oh my God, I want to go. And I screamed and I shouted. So she couldn't talk to me because like I didn't want to talk to her. And she certainly didn't want to talk to me in the state that I was in. But every day after, and I'll never forget this, every day I was in the hospital, she would pop her head in the door and she'd just say hello. That's all she'd say. And then eventually, like, you know, about a month or 6 weeks or whatever it was down the line, she was like sitting on the bed chatting and we had the best of conversations. And she told me, like, she said to me, Claire, she goes, with the attitude that I have, and like, that is thanks to my parents, my sister, my brother, like, they never let me give up on myself. They never let me, like, feel sorry for myself.
Yeah, you were given the resilience, but you're always treated as normal because you are normal. Yeah. You're treated as Claire.
Yeah.
But you want to change that in the outside world as well, because I touched on it in the email. But no matter where you go, whether it's to
everywhere
work, whether it's
go,
to socialise,
everywhere,
whether it's to shop, you are made to feel
different.
That you're different.
All the time. And like, and I nearly have to sell myself. Like in that first minute, I nearly have to say, like, my name is Claire. I have had, like, I was the first person in Ireland to have limb lengthening surgery. I nearly have to
sell yourself, and you shouldn't have to define yourself by achondroplasia.
Yeah.
You shouldn't have to mention that. It's obvious.
Yeah.
But you should just be treated as normal.
Yeah,
and that's the message you want to get out today.
So
for people to think twice.
Yeah. But that is, like, and I want to start a conversation. And I do, like, I want to challenge, like, the makeup, the media, shops on the high street. Like, why isn't there, like, I look at Paddy Smith recently and I think, oh my God, such an amazing guy. Like, he went into the circle and he, you know, nobody knew he was disabled until he, so they started loving him for him. And then when he spoke about his crutches, you know, like, it came in
later on.
But like, people knew him before they knew his disability. It's like me on the phone or me in the email. You know, people, you know, they get a sense. But when they see someone with, like, achondroplasia or, like, you know.
Try put that aside and just see the person.
Yeah.
Well, Claire, I think you're amazing. You've set up your Instagram page, Make
Disability Visible.
You've started the conversation, and I think you're really brave to come on and to send me that email in the first place. And thank you very, very much.
And thanks a million.
All right, that's it for this week. We are over time. My thanks to my producer, John Fardy, researcher Simon Keane, and Jojo Cardoza was on sound. Vincent Wall's up next.